thing. Then he told me to go put it in this big garbage bin. I was crying because these were all my belongings. This man had come over, and I was crying, and I asked him to help me get my clothes into the garbage because I couldn't reach, and my father came over and said, "Hey, get away from her." I finally got it in the garbage. When Kate went back to their apartment, Brad ordered her into her room and told her that he was putting something on the door and it would go off if she tried to open the door and he would know. At this point, Kate was terrified. Her father had pushed and knocked her around before. He had told her how much he wanted to hit her. She crept into her closet and began to pray. But Brad wouldn't permit it. He followed her and peered into the closet, demanding to know what she was doing. "I'm praying," she said quietly. "You don't do that in there," he said, and grabbed at her. He lifted her in one muscled arm and held her above him with her back pressing the ceiling. He threw her down on the bed and kicked her. Then he ordered her to stay out of her closet and warned her not to cause trouble. Kate stayed quietly in her room. She believed every word her father had told her, and she was sure he had booby-trapped her door. Frantically, her mind raced, thinking of ways to escape. She thought she might be able to go out the window. She might go to the police and tell them about her father. "I'd told him once that I was going to turn him in for emotional abuse, and he laughed at me. He said, 'Who's going to believe you? You're a little kid. All I'd have to do is tell them you're just a little liar. You're just garbage. They're not going to believe you.'" Kate remembered that and figured there was no point in trying to escape her father. No one would believe her. Brad had allowed Kate to go to the rehearsal for the graduation ceremonies from the 8th grade, and she longed to graduate with her class. She had been in Houston over 6 months now, and she wanted to finish the school year. It would be some contact with normalcy, some way to prove to herself that all those months had not been a complete waste. But Kate never went back after her father ruined her clothes with garbage and forced her to throw away everything that mattered to her. How could she go to school? She had no clothes. Kate never knew what she had done to set her father off, to turn him into a raving, frothing stranger. She didn't realize, of course, that she had lived out the same scenario as her Aunt Susan. When Sanford Cunningham was angry, Susan had hidden in her closet, too, clutching her dog close to her. Even Brad, who seemed so all-powerful at the age of 34, had cowered in terror when he was a little boy, waiting for his father to come home and mete out the beatings his mother decreed. Kate's mother couldn't help her. Her father barely looked at her. She wasn't sure how to find her other relatives. Everyone was far away in Washington State. And then, finally, she learned she was going home. She could scarcely breathe for fear her father would change his mind. But when he left Houston, Kate was, thank God, in the car. "He drove me to Yakima," she said. After that, Brad never showed any interest in having Kate with him. She saw her father a few times when she was 15 or 16, and never again thereafter, not until she had a memorable confrontation with him in 1995. Chapter 21. June 1983 may well have been the turning point of Brad's life. Ever since he was a little boy, he had hustled, always looking upward at the next step on the ladder of success. Financial success, personal success, and yes, sexual success. His older sister Ethel had referred to him in a derogatory fashion as the local black market kid, commenting that he was always looking for a way to make a fast dollar. His father, Sanford, had been the same way and was undoubtedly a model for his only son. According to his youngest daughter, Susan, Sanford had won approval from his father and uncles by being quick with his checkbook. He had always wanted a better house and a better truck than anyone in his family. Eventually, Sanford had wanted a better wife, and Brad seemed to want a better wife often. He had been married to Cheryl longer than anyone so far. He stayed 3.5 years with Lonnie Ann, 6 months with Cynthia, 7 months with Lauren. Cheryl was determined to make her marriage work, sure that everything was going to be better soon. Sanford Cunningham's best house was only a middle-class rambler on a busy street in a working man's suburb. His son wanted much more. Unlike his father, Brad had Indian blood in his veins, but it was a heritage that he was ashamed of. As he grew to be a man, he had distanced himself from his roots as quickly as he could. Even so, no worldly possession and no woman had ever yet lived up to his perception of what he felt he needed to enhance the persona he presented to the world. No woman until Cheryl. She was beautiful and brilliant and perfect. She loved Brad completely and single-mindedly, and she had bent to his will early in their relationship. She had given him 2 fine sons, and she was once again earning a very comfortable living. Brad was not. His rise as a real estate entrepreneur had been almost meteoric, but when his soaring star faltered, it faltered badly. In June 1983, it plunged straight down to earth. He surely saw it coming. His abuse of Kate that spring in Houston may have indicated something more than pure meanness. Brad was more likely a man walking on the sharp edge of career disaster who diffused his own anxiety by berating the only person around who was no threat to him. His behavior was hardly admirable, but if it was a reaction to the crumbling of his dreams, it was easier to understand than cruelty for its own sake. Brad had kept up his public facade, going each day to his fine office in his shiny Mercedes. If Kate's perception of her father's financial picture, her memory of his boasting about hidden assets and free-willing charges on credit cards he would never have to pay, was accurate, Brad did not go down without a plan. Perhaps he did have money no one knew about, and perhaps he didn't disclose all his assets to the bankruptcy court. He had always lived an opulent lifestyle, a few steps beyond what he could really afford. He was probably grasping everything he could on his way down. But with the Parkwood Plaza project irrevocably gone, he was a man starting over. Meanwhile, Cheryl was working hard at Garvey Schubert, where she had made many friends. Her early promise as a litigator had blossomed. She was good. She was more than good. She was partnership material. One of the partners in the firm recalled the first time he realized that Cheryl was a woman to be reckoned with. "We were at a partners' meeting in Seattle, and Cheryl was conducting a deposition. We stood outside the conference room and heard her chewing out 2 senior members of the bar. We all thought, 'Wow, she's feisty. We've really got a great litigator.' She was creative, very bright, tenacious, and the clients loved her." Brock Adams was a partner in Garvey Schubert until his election to the U.S. Senate. The law firm that began in Seattle in 1979 had had any number of top litigators, but Cheryl Keaton would be remembered as one of the best in the history of our law firm and top-notch. She was a woman for all seasons. Her future seemed to be limitless. Cheryl had kept the home fires burning for Brad. She was still living on Bainbridge Island, and she depended on her sister Susan, her cousin Katana King, or Sally Nelson, a babysitter, to take care of Jess and Michael while she was at work. Sally worked for Cheryl for only 4 months. She said later that she was nervous because Brad had so many guns and because she saw that he was irrationally jealous of Cheryl. He hinted that she was probably cheating on him with other men while he was in Texas, but Cheryl would have needed superhuman energy to find the time and/or the enthusiasm to carry on an affair. She left the house early in the morning to catch the ferry to Seattle, worked a long day, and headed home often after dark. What free time she had, she spent with Jess and Michael, and, if he was in town, with Brad. Besides, Cheryl was carrying another child. She was pregnant for the third time in 4 years and expected to give birth around Thanksgiving 1983. With the workload she was handling at her law firm, and with all the responsibility of caring for Jess and Michael while Brad was gone, she was exhausted most of the time. It was, of course, not the most propitious time for her to be pregnant, but she was happy about it nonetheless. As she always had, Cheryl continued to believe that things were going to get better in her marriage. It was terrible for Brad to lose his Houston project, but she believed at least that meant he would be home and they would be living together as a family again. When Brad was away, it was easy for Cheryl to think like that. But when he was home, all the warm, good things she had planned just seemed to slip away. She tried. She tried very hard. She and Brad socialized with Sharon McCulloch and her husband, and sometimes Brad could be charming. Even Sharon had changed her mind about him. She liked him a lot better now than in the days when she first cared for newborn Jess. If Cheryl and Brad needed a babysitter, the McCullochs allowed their teenage daughter to take the ferry to Bainbridge, with the understanding that Brad would be picking her up. When Brad wanted to be, he was the best person in the world to be around. But when he turned on someone, he was another person, the most formidable of opponents. He was so intelligent, and he had an uncanny knack at spotting a person's most vulnerable area. Then he would go for the jugular. Sharon soon saw that she had been right about Brad in the first place. "This is a man who was so smooth. It's hard to understand. I trusted him. And then everything fell apart. He was so cunning and so persuasive. It was just chilling. It was diabolical. It was eerie. He turned on me a couple of times and frightened me, too." After Brad moved back to Washington from Houston, he was often moody and angry and hard to please. Not hard, impossible to please. Jess and Michael had been so anxious for their daddy to be home with them, but when he was around, he ignored them. He wasn't working, but he continued to spend money as if he were. When Cheryl demurred, he turned on her and raged. It didn't matter that she was supporting him and carrying his child. He would brook no interference with his preferred lifestyle. Cheryl's sister Susan saw it too. Despite all the covering up Cheryl tried to do, she was a woman clearly miserable. Worse, she was afraid. Susan had been a child when Cheryl started seeing Brad, and even then she knew that something was wrong. Now Susan was a very mature 17 and had become more of a confidant to her sister. She had also become a close-up observer to the steady disintegration of Cheryl's marriage. It might be expected that a man who had seen his multi-million-dollar project evaporate would be morose, particularly when his wife's career was soaring. Despite his boast that he would win his suit against the construction company, Brad's financial picture was grim. He had had it all. He had lost it all. His temperament, never predictable, became even more mercurial. Cheryl had done everything she could to support him, both financially and emotionally, and yet he seemed to blame her for his troubles. Then, inexplicably, Brad suddenly moved out of their house on Bainbridge Island. "Cheryl would come home from work, and Brad's furniture would be gone," Susan recalled. "There wouldn't be anything left that was really valuable. The roll-top desk, the leather chairs, the TV were gone. He would leave their bed and the kid stuff." Cheryl was constantly off balance. Brad was home. Brad had moved out. Brad was traveling. Brad was back. As far as she could determine, he wasn't working, and he certainly didn't seem to be earning any money. He had filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. He blamed the bonding and construction companies for that. Brad warned Cheryl that his legal action had unleashed sinister forces that would have no compunction about destroying him, her, and the boys. With Brad, there was so much to be afraid of. First, there was his own anger if anyone broke his rules. Second, there were malignant entities that he said waited in the background to destroy him and all he stood for, and he was ultimately convincing when he spoke of unseen danger. He had not married a naive and gullible woman. None of his wives had been dumb. Cheryl was, in fact, an extremely brilliant woman. But Brad could convince almost anyone of anything, and that included attorneys and big business executives. For Cheryl, life became a constant walk through erratic situations. One misstep and the calmness she had always sought evaporated. In only a few years, everything had changed so radically. At work, she was still totally in control, efficient and effective. At home, she no longer knew what Brad would do, or worse, what the people who were after him might do. Still, if it was true that they were all in danger, Cheryl wondered why Brad didn't stay home with her and the little boys to protect them. When she came home to find him and his possessions gone the first time, she feared he had been abducted, even murdered. Only later would she find out that he had left of his own volition and for his own reasons. Cheryl never really understood what made Brad move out or where he had gone. She was afraid to be alone on the island, but she was more afraid that Brad, or someone, would come back during the day and take more things out of the house. She asked Susan to move in with her and help her take care of Jess and Michael. "But I knew she wanted someone there, too, while she was at work," Susan sighed, remembering. "Someone to guard the house. She was very upset, and she was pregnant." Susan loved looking after her two young nephews. "They were both smart," she said. "But Jess was more introspective, and Michael was all high energy with a short attention span." Michael was still a toddler then, and Jess was 3. "He was brilliant," Susan recalled. "He asked me once, 'Where does glass come from?' And then he went into one of his meditative states. Later he popped up with, 'Sand. Glass is made out of sand.' Jess always had phenomenal knowledge and concentration, even when he was a really little kid." While Cheryl worried about their finances, Brad continued to drive a Mercedes. Not just one, but several. Susan, a typical teenager, thought at first that his cars were kinda neat. He had the mammoth Unimag. He had 2 4-door Mercedes sedans, a Mercedes station wagon, and a classic red 2-seater Mercedes convertible. Susan was sure that Brad had to have money secreted somewhere. "Well, I just don't know where it is," Cheryl said wearily. "It doesn't do me any good." A woman who had always been in control, who thought precisely and rationally, Cheryl was now often scattered and distraught. She consulted a psychologist in 1983, hoping that she could find a way to run her life as smoothly as she ran her law practice and took care of her sons. Sharon McCulloch was still Cheryl's daycare provider and continued to be a close friend. Sharon admired Cheryl tremendously. She was a super mom. "I've taught school, I've taken care of over 40 kids, and I've never known a mom in my life as committed to her kids. She could be so busy, and if I called and said Jess had a little fever and asked her if I should have the doctor look at his ears, she would be there in 20 minutes. Every birthday she gave a party. Her kids were her life. She was the highest energy person I've ever met in my life. She was a perfectionist about herself. It's a little thing, but one time her bra strap slipped down, and it was just pristine white. That was the way she was. Her house was spotless. She was good at everything she did." Sharon called Cheryl the mother of the world. She had to be. Jess was 3.5, Michael was 21 months old, she was 4 months pregnant, and now Brad was talking about how he might just go to live in Yakima 150 miles away for a while. He had some interest left in tribal land over there. He was thinking of starting a car wash and a laundromat. There was some acreage he thought they should buy. Cheryl just stared at him, appalled. She decided she had to move. It was too difficult and too expensive for her to stay on Bainbridge Island. She needed to be closer to her work and to her doctor. She rented a house in Somerset, an upper-middle-class neighborhood near Bellevue on the east side of King County. Now she would no longer have to depend on the ferry service to get to work, although the commute over the floating bridge could sometimes be frustrating. Brad moved with his family to Somerset, but then he left for Yakima. Cheryl pinned up the big map again to show Jess and Michael where their daddy was. Despite everything, she was still fighting to hold the image of the perfect little family together. The boys were probably too young to understand, but she felt it vital that she keep talking about Brad, letting them know that they did have a father. If Cheryl was beginning to be afraid for Brad, she was also often afraid of Brad. Even so, she clung to her hope that somehow things were going to get better. Sometimes her sister and her friends wanted to shake her and tell her to wake up and smell the coffee. One day, Sharon McCulloch and her daughter Mary visited Cheryl in the Somerset house. "I remember that there was this huge stuffed animal there, and I said something to Cheryl about it," Sharon recalled. She said, "Brad bought it, and I'm going to be paying for it for a long time." As they left, they walked through the garage to get to their car. Sharon was stunned to see the number of guns in the garage. She was more shocked to see an elongated woven basket. It looked exactly like a coffin, an Indian child's coffin. Her jaw dropped, and she turned toward Cheryl to ask what it was.
"Oh," Cheryl said, embarrassed. "That's Brad's idea of discipline, keeping that in the garage for the boys."
When they were naughty, she said uncomfortably, Brad took them out and showed them the coffin.
"He tells them that, well, that's where bad boys end up."
Brad was into killing things, death, Sharon remembered. He would take the boys to Yakima, and they'd come home with boxes of things they had killed. Squirrels and rabbits and snakes, prairie dogs. They weren't killing anything. They were just tiny boys. But that's what Brad brought back for souvenirs of their trip. It used to just make Cheryl crazy. On one of the trips in August 1983, Brad sent back a postcard to Cheryl. It was addressed, "Wife Cunningham," and the message was one word written in huge letters, "Sex." A card from Jess, but written by Brad, said, "I'm really getting bigger. I take care of Michael almost all the time, especially at night so Dad and Sean can go out drinking and dancing. Dad said I did real good." It was, of course, a joke. Jess was only 3. In October, Brad wrote a letter to Jess for his 4th birthday, apologizing for not being there. He sent 3 gifts. The first was a tooth from Brad's backhoe that had broken off when he was digging a water line to a house he was renovating on property he and Cheryl had purchased in Tampico. "You can keep this on your shelf downstairs to remind you of our backhoe." The second present was shell casings. "These are spent bullets from one of Dad's rifles. A pack of wild dogs came into Tampico last week and started raising havoc. Daddy shot 2 of these wild dogs near your house, and these are the bullets from my gun. I hope you had a nice and happy birthday. I love you very, very, very much, and promise to see you again someday when things are better. Love, Dad." Cheryl was all alone with the little boys for week after week. Nevertheless, she continued to make excuses for Brad. When he missed one of the boys' birthdays, she said, "Daddy can't be here because he's making money," or, "Daddy can't call you because he doesn't have a phone." If Brad was making money, Cheryl saw none of it. And as 1983 waned, so did her hopes for a happy ending. If she sometimes felt she was being punished for taking away another woman's husband, no one could blame her. She was living at the edges of hell with a man who had become a stranger. Instead of things getting better, they were growing immeasurably worse. Cheryl knew Sharon well enough by this time that she no longer tried to mask her true emotions. She was afraid. On November 18, 1983, the Friday night before Cheryl's third son was born, the two women met for dinner at Bellevue Square. Sharon could see how miserable and terrified Cheryl was. They sat in a quiet booth while Cheryl poured out her fears. She was as pregnant as a woman could be, 9 full months, and she trembled and cried softly as she tried to tell Sharon how bad things were in her marriage. A no-nonsense person herself, Sharon couldn't understand why Cheryl clung to a marriage that seemed more like a prison sentence. "How can you live like this?" she asked Cheryl.
"I don't have a choice." "You always have a choice. You don't have to live like this."
Cheryl tried to explain.
"No, you don't understand. If I leave, he'll kill me."
"Cheryl, no, really. He has always threatened that if I ever left him, he would kill me."
"Cheryl, you're an attorney. Those kinds of things just don't happen. You could stop him."
"No. If I ever tried to get custody of the boys,"
Cheryl said, her voice choked with tears,
"he would kill me. The only thing I could do, Sharon, if I ever got custody of the boys, is to leave the country and change my name. I'm between a rock and a hard place. If I don't get them away from him, their lives are in danger. They're not safe. He has enemies everywhere. They won't live to be adults. And if I try to get custody, he'll kill me, probably."
Sharon didn't like Brad. He was as abrasive and supercilious as anyone she had ever met. She had come to think of him as evil. But what kind of intrigue was he into where someone wanted to kill him and his sons? There was no doubt in Sharon's mind that Cheryl believed he had enemies. But was it really true? And was it true that he might kill her if she tried to get custody of the boys? On the Monday following Cheryl's tearful unburdening to her good friend, she presented Brad with another son, Philip. He now had 6 children by 3 wives. Brad's first 2 children, Kate and Brent, were, for the moment, safely out of his reach. Their mother, Lonnie Ann, had her bachelor's degree in physical education. She was teaching in high school and working on her master's in kinesiotherapy. For a woman who had truly begun to believe that she was irretrievably stupid, she was doing remarkably well in college. Her coursework involved memorizing all the muscles and tendons of the body and how they worked, and she had no trouble at all doing that. Lonnie Ann was smarter than anyone had realized. No matter what Brad had done to destroy all traces of self-worth in his first wife, she had survived and had even begun to thrive. Her goal was to work with patients with sports injuries and in general rehabilitative medicine. Lonnie Ann's other goal was to get as far away from the Northwest and Brad as possible. She was grateful to have her daughter back after the nightmare months Kate had spent with Brad in Houston. She was going to need counseling. They were both going to need counseling, untold years of therapy, so they would no longer be afraid and would no longer feel like garbage. When Philip was born, Brad came over from Yakima and visited Cheryl briefly. Mary Hilfer, one of her friends, recalled that he bought a new puppy for the boys.
"That was the last thing Cheryl needed with a new baby. A puppy to look after, too."
Now that Brad was the father of 3 more boys, all under one roof, he didn't seem nearly as obsessed with keeping his other children under his thumb. Lauren Stoneham was vastly relieved when he didn't exercise his visitation rights with Amy in anything more than a sporadic fashion. But her relationship with Brad was no longer overtly adversarial, and he sometimes called and talked to her as if they were close friends. Lauren was certainly not going to bring up the past, and Brad seemed to have forgotten the agony he had put her through. He filled her in with more details about his high-stakes court battle in Texas, blaming the officers of the construction company, the architect, and the bonding company for the delays that had thrown him into bankruptcy. In his usual convincing manner, he told Lauren that if they had listened to him and met their commitments in getting the buildings done, his current financial disaster would never have happened. Brad explained that he had filed for Chapter 11 protection because he still had all of his assets. He just had to find a different way to tap into them. But if he did recoup any money, Lauren didn't hear about it. After 1983, Brad never paid her any more child support for Amy. That was fine with Lauren. They didn't need it. And it was a relief to know that Brad was no longer pushing for his parental rights. Chapter 22. Cheryl was the primary parent to Jess, Michael, and the newborn Philip. As her friend Sharon later said, Cheryl parented those boys essentially alone. She was also the primary breadwinner in her marriage. Brad was always gone, to Yakima, to Texas, to Canada, and to any number of other places. He had mysterious missions connected with the financial fiasco in Houston. He was setting up a business for his father in Yakima. But beyond that, Cheryl was never really sure why he had to be away so often. The map on the wall bristled with pins as she patiently showed her little boys where Daddy is. 1984 was a year of separations and strained reunions, a year of despair and even of occasional hope. Cheryl was afraid of Brad and of the truth she acknowledged in moments of solitary but searing evaluation of her marriage. She realized at last that he was fully capable of killing her if she crossed him. She knew that all of the energy and brilliance and charm that had once bewitched her could just as easily be turned against her. And it wasn't only Brad. He had warned her that there were mysterious forces stalking not only him, but his whole family. He could handle himself, but he didn't want his sons to pay a tragic price. Brad kept Cheryl continually off balance, constantly afraid, and yet part of her still loved him. Only a woman who has been battered either physically or emotionally can understand why. The bad alternated with the good, and when things were good, they were tremendously good. There is no creature on earth more persuasive than a contrite wife abuser, and no woman who wants to believe more than the abused wife. Cheryl was a woman with superior intellectual strength, but she was also a woman with a tender and romantic heart who detested the idea of a second divorce. Brad had swept her away from her first marriage. If she divorced him, she feared revealing herself as a woman who could not give what marriage demanded. Worse, this time a divorce would mean that her three little boys would lose either their father or their mother. She had grave doubts that Brad would let her keep Jess, Michael, and Philip. He had told her otherwise often enough, and she couldn't bear the thought of losing them. If Brad did accede to her having custody, they would probably never see him again. He had threatened to walk completely out of their lives. There would be no need to put pins in a map, because their daddy wouldn't be coming home, and it wouldn't matter where he was. She probably wouldn't even know. Cheryl was stubborn and focused as a litigator, and she was just as stubborn in hanging on to her marriage. But she wasn't stupid. She no longer believed that her marriage would one day miraculously metamorphose into one filled with joy and security. She adjusted her sights lower, and somehow she was able to quiet the hysteria she had felt just before Philip was born, able to relegate the fear to her subconscious, although it still lay in wait like a cancer, ready to burst forth and grow. Cheryl had always made friends wherever she went, both female and male, and more than ever now, they helped her maintain her equilibrium. John Burke, her old friend from the Uniguard insurance office before either of them went to law school, was still in touch. She rarely saw him, but they wrote and talked on the phone. Burke was married, so was Cheryl. They were platonic friends who admired each other a great deal. Eric Lindenauer was another good friend. When he had graduated from Willamette University Law School in Salem, Oregon in 1983, the firm of Garvey Schubert was anxious to hire him. He wanted to work in commercial litigation, and he specifically searched for a law firm where he would have a mentor, someone to teach me the fine points of litigation, the things you can't learn in law school. Garvey Schubert assured Lindenauer they would find him a skilled litigator to guide him in his fledgling years. That mentor was Cheryl Keaton. At 34, Cheryl was a good decade older than Lindenauer, yet they became good friends as well as mentor and student. She took him under her wing and taught him the subtle nuances that separate an outstanding litigator from an adequate one. He was amazed at her professional ability and grateful that she was so generous in sharing her experience. In the beginning, Lindenauer knew very little about Cheryl's personal life, nothing beyond the fact that her husband had business interests that required him to travel a lot. She was a private person and a very proud woman. No one really knew what Cheryl's life was like. However, the people who worked in Brad and Cheryl's home couldn't help but notice that theirs was a strange, edgy marriage. Lee Malden babysat for them Monday through Friday in the summer of 1984. She joined a parade of babysitters who would go on record to say that they didn't care for Mr. Cunningham. In a statement she gave 6 years later, Lee remembered Brad's violence and his temper. She recalled that he once removed the tires from Cheryl's car so she couldn't drive. During one of his many precipitous abandonments, Cheryl had changed the locks on the Somerset house, but Brad broke in, shouting threats. Lee Malden heard it all and was appalled. Fortuitously, perhaps, Brad continued to stay away from home for most of 1984, spending a lot of time in Yakima with his father. He bought Sanford a gas station in Tampico. Even though Cheryl was the only one working, nothing was ever too good for Brad's father. The business was doomed to failure almost from the start, and it soon went belly up. Brad was confident, however, that his plan for a laundromat and car wash would be more successful. He had also moved a lot of heavy equipment onto the property that he and Cheryl owned in Tampico. Cheryl wasn't sure where the equipment had come from or how he was paying for it. There were tractors, backhoes, bulldozers, a crawler loader, and a number of trucks and trailers. Brad was bankrupt, but he never stopped acquiring things, and Cheryl knew she too was liable for his debts. She worried about it, staying awake nights. In late 1984, Cheryl received an offer that seemed to be a lifeline she could grab onto. Garvey Schubert was growing and prospering, and the firm credited her for a good deal of its success. There were now 40 attorneys in the Seattle office, a small number in Washington, D.C., and a new branch in Portland, Oregon. Would Cheryl be interested in transferring to Portland? It would mean a full partnership for her. Of course she would still be returning often to Seattle to work on her cases in progress, and she knew almost all of the Garvey Schubert staff who were already in Portland. Eric Lindenauer had moved down there a few months before, and they often worked on cases together. Career-wise, it was a wonderful opportunity for Cheryl. Personally, it could be either a chance to separate from Brad or, in the best of all possible worlds, a fresh start for them in a new city. A geographical solution, perhaps, to the doubts and recriminations that had well-nigh crippled their marriage. Although Cheryl hated to leave Seattle, it wouldn't be the cultural and climate shock it had been to move to Houston. Portland and Seattle both have beautiful summers and rainy winters. Seattle has Mount Rainier, and Portland has Mount Hood, snowy mountain peaks to gaze at, and both cities are built around water. In one way, Portland seemed an even better place for Cheryl to live. It was an hour closer to her old hometown of Longview, old friends, and her family. Tentatively, she broached the subject to Brad. To her surprise, he agreed that a move to Portland might be a good idea. While he still didn't have a regular job, he was confident he could find something that suited him just as well in Oregon as he could in Washington. And so, in January 1985, they moved into a rental house in Gresham. It was not a lavish home, but pleasant and roomy. The rent was something over $900 a month, and Cheryl paid it just as she paid all the household bills. Garvey Schubert's Portland offices were state-of-the-art, very plush with thick carpets, lovely paintings, and expensive furnishings. Even the lighting was computerized so that each office's lights went on when someone walked through the door. Cheryl would have her own paralegal assistant and her own secretary, and she herself would continue to mentor young attorneys fresh from law school. She was finally at a place in her legal career that she had always dreamed of. Maybe somehow things would be all right after all. Since Brad would be job hunting, he and Cheryl hired a babysitter, 19-year-old Marnie O'Connor. She was a very pretty girl, and the little Cunningham boys liked her right away. Cheryl was glad to see that, and she was reassured by how dependable Marnie seemed to be. That was important because she expected to be shuttling between Portland and Seattle over the next year or more. She would be working on a huge ongoing medical malpractice litigation until it was settled, and when she was in the Portland offices of Garvey Schubert, she knew she might sometimes have to work 7 days a week. Brad was the furthest thing from a house husband anyone could imagine. Even when he was unemployed, Cheryl couldn't count on him to stay with the boys. She had to have Marnie there, or she would never have a moment's peace while she was away from her children. Brad found a job in Oregon in the spring of 1985, and it was a position with no little prestige. He was hired to head the income property loan department of the Citizens Savings and Loan Bank in Salem. He would have a private office, and three employees would report to him. Oregon's capital city is 47 miles south of Portland, a fairly easy commute along the I-5 freeway. Besides that, Brad would be going in the opposite direction from most commuters, so he could expect less than an hour's drive each way as he cruised along in one or the other Mercedes. Citizens Savings and Loan had hired a most impressive department manager. Brad dressed like a GQ model, his smile was wide and confident, and his resume showed more than 15 years of experience in one aspect of real estate or another. The Houston credits alone were imposing. He clearly knew income property, and he presented himself extremely well in his interviews. Whether Brad mentioned his ongoing litigation in Texas or his bankruptcy filing is not known. The employees at Citizens who reported directly to Brad were female. Even though he made no secret of the fact that he was a married man, it was obvious that he thoroughly enjoyed the company of women, and he was a pleasure to work for. He was compelling and dynamic, he drove fantastic cars, and he had an air of wealth about him, almost as if he didn't need to work at all, but could have chosen to remain in the leisure class he had been born into. No one would ever have guessed the truth about the modest home where Sanford and Rosemary had raised Brad and his two sisters. No one would ever have suspected his Indian heritage. Through plastic surgery, education, a certain natural savvy, and the liberal use of Cheryl's income, Brad had completely recreated himself. None of his co-workers at Citizens knew, of course, that his cars, clothes, and money came not from his own labors, but from his wife's. Cheryl worked harder and harder, but however much money she made, Brad always managed to spend more. "If he brought home a pizza now and then," Cheryl's sister recalled, "he thought he was doing his part." Cheryl hoped that Brad's new job would help rebuild their financial base. After so many years when his only job had been his dogged attention to the suit he had filed against the Texas Construction Company, they were both making good salaries. Understandably, Cheryl earned a great deal more than Brad, but had they pulled together, they would have rapidly been in good financial shape. In truth, Brad's salary made no dent at all in their debts. He continued to overspend, buying whatever he wanted. Cheryl had paid all the household bills since 1983. The rent, the utilities, the boys' babysitters and schools, the groceries. Although she deferred to Brad's insistence that the accounts be listed in his name. He was, after all, the man of the family. He didn't want people to know that he was living off Cheryl. Sometimes it seemed as if Brad spent money just to spend money, and Cheryl despaired of ever catching up, telling her sister Susan, "Look at all this stuff," gesturing toward the piles of toys that Brad had bought and then left to gather dust. "And I can't pay all the bills." She resigned herself to debt, Susan remembered. The garage in the Gresham house had four-wheelers, three-wheelers, water skis, jet skis, Brad's clothes, Brad's shoes. One time, and this makes me so sad now to remember it, Cheryl really needed some new underwear. Just some simple plain underwear, and she didn't have enough money to buy it. It was ludicrous that she should be so laden down with debt. Due to transfers of other partners, when she moved to the Garvey Schubert office in Portland, Cheryl became not only the most senior partner in that city, but also an owner of the firm, eligible for salary, profit-sharing, and benefits. In 1986, her base salary was $50,000. She was also awarded a merit bonus of $4,500, and on top of that, she received benefits worth another 15% of her salary. She had been picked for the Portland office because of her leadership ability and because litigators traditionally bring more money into a firm, and Cheryl brought in more than her share. "Cheryl was a business developer," another partner commented. "She represented Weyerhaeuser, for instance." In 1984, senior partner Gary Strauss attended a product liability trial involving formaldehyde ingestion. Cheryl gave her closing arguments after the others had all spoken. Strauss found her brilliant, poignant, awesome in a room full of attorneys. The jury told her that afterward, that was the way a closing argument should be. This pleased Strauss. He knew how embarrassed Cheryl had been about Brad's filing for bankruptcy and his constant litigation. "She wasn't very happy about all the lawyers battling each other in Brad's suits," he remembered. "She had been hesitant even about accepting a partnership because of that." Even though Cheryl made Brad's standard of living possible, he complained when she had to stay in Seattle overnight, insinuating, as always, that she was sleeping with other men. Brad himself was seldom without female company. From puberty, he had had his choice of women, and they always played by his rules. Now, living in Gresham, working in Salem, with Cheryl off and gone overnight, Brad essentially lived the life of a single man. It would be impossible to pinpoint whether he began his affair with the Cunningham babysitter, 19-year-old Marnie O'Connor, or his liaison with Lilia Sarnan first. It would be a moot point anyway. Brad had always been adept at balancing a marriage and two or more affairs. There was no reason that Marnie and Lilia should ever meet. Cheryl had no hint that Brad was sleeping with either of them. Lilia Sarnan had worked at Citizens Savings for 4 years when Brad took over as her supervisor. She found him tremendously attractive and very understanding. Lilia knew he was married, but that didn't bother her. Apparently his wife was so caught up in her career that she had little time for Brad. Although Lilia dressed like the complete career woman, Brad hadn't missed the long, slow looks she gave him or the way she accidentally brushed against him as they were going over loan applications. He saw that Lilia was spectacularly attractive behind her horn-rimmed glasses and her loose clothes. She had perfectly aligned, delicate features and long, silky ash-blonde hair. Careful not to be too obvious in the bank's offices, Brad and Lilia began a physical affair in the late summer of 1985. They would have an oddly connected relationship that lasted for a long time. While Lilia knew about his wife, she did not know he was also sleeping with his babysitter. Whether she had any long-term plans for Brad is questionable. Lilia was intelligent and pragmatic, and of all Brad's women, she may have seen beyond his complex and contrived facade early enough to steal her own emotional response. It is even possible that Lilia used Brad almost as much as he used most of the women in his life. Lilia believed that Brad was very wealthy. She had every reason to. He seemed not only quite rich, but munificent with his money.
"He was not overly generous,"
she would say one day with her usual understatement.
"But he was very supportive of the sad situation I was in."
And indeed, there would come a time when Lilia needed more than flowers, fancy dinners, and lingerie. Although she was a young woman, her health was not good, and it deteriorated further shortly after she and Brad became intimate. 1985 was an almost schizophrenic year for Cheryl. She loved her career, she adored her little boys, and she was finding wonderfully loyal friends in the Portland office of Garvey Schubert. Along with her extended family, Cheryl's friends kept her going. Her marriage was little more than a sham. All the Pollyanna philosophizing in the world wasn't going to turn the home she and Brad had rented in Gresham into anything more than an armed camp. Cheryl sometimes wondered why Brad stayed with her and the boys, but she must have suspected it was because she had become his cash cow. Cheryl could count on nothing. She walked through her days, awaiting the next assault, teetering emotionally on the edge of some precipice from which she might never escape. Brad still pulled his move furniture out, move furniture in games, but by the fall of 1985, he didn't take just his furniture, he took Cheryl's too. There was something ultimately demoralizing about coming home to a house emptied of its furniture, to see the dents in the carpet where couches and chairs and televisions should have been, to watch dust bunnies drifting lazily across bare floors when a door was opened. By mutual agreement, Brad and Cheryl had enrolled Jess and Michael in the Franciscan Montessori Earth School administered by Mother Francine Cardew. It was an excellent and much sought-after school in Portland, with a philosophy that nurtured and encouraged creativity and independence in children. Exceptionally intelligent children, like the Cunningham boys, thrived in the Montessori atmosphere. Mother Francine was a serene presence, but in no way a cloistered nun. In her many years of experience in running the Montessori school, she had seen all manner of problems with parents and children and dealt with them competently and tactfully. She had, however, seen nothing like the bitterness between Brad and Cheryl. Every encounter with them was unpleasant. Early in the 1985-86 school year, Mother Francine was informed of an altercation in the hallway. The Cunninghams were arguing loudly outside the secretary's office. She was grateful their children didn't observe that fight, but Mother Francine was appalled at one volatile argument that did take place in front of Jess and Michael. The boys had been waiting for someone to pick them up after school, two lonely little figures clinging together as they watched the other children leave the school one by one until they were the last ones left.
"Daycare children were to be picked up by 6:15 p.m., Mother Francine recalled,
and the school set $1 a minute penalty for late pickups, more to protect the children than to add to the school's budget. One day,
no one came for the Cunningham boys.
Eventually, both Brad and Cheryl showed up, and each blamed the other for failing to pick up Jess and Michael on time.
"He was very angry. She was quieter, saying to him, 'You were responsible,'
Mother Francine said with a shudder.
'I just remember I didn't want to be there. I was embarrassed. The boys were embarrassed and agitated. They wanted their parents to leave.'
More and more, Jess, Michael, and to a lesser extent Philip, were pulled in two directions like stretchy silly putty figures. Their mother wanted desperately to protect them and give them a secure world. Their father used them to harass their mother, and the boys were the most vulnerable part of Cheryl's life. She could face anything, anything, but losing them. The product liability cases that drew Cheryl back to Seattle on an almost weekly basis had begun in the late spring of 1985. Garvey Schubert represented a company that had manufactured an artificial heart valve. The attorney Cheryl faced in litigating sessions, who represented patients whose heart valves had allegedly malfunctioned, was Jim Griswold, one-time president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Griswold described such litigation as a very difficult kind of case. Cheryl and her co-counsel John Allison practically had to take a course in cardiovascular surgery in order to defend their clients. Griswold had come up against hundreds of defense litigators. He had been in practice for 4 decades. When he was later asked to describe Cheryl Keaton, he paused, searching for words. Excellent. Outstanding wouldn't cover it. She was intense, professional. She always knew what she was doing. She always knew where she was going. She was never thrown off. At one time, Griswold was on a committee to compile a list of attorneys to be recommended to the Oregon governor for judgeships. Cheryl was on that list, termed highly qualified. Cheryl opposed Griswold in the artificial heart valve litigation for 1.5 years, and as far as he could see, she was never less than an extremely competent lawyer. Whatever emotions might have been churning inside, Cheryl kept them there. Later, Griswold would be amazed to learn what her private life had been like. Cheryl always managed to keep her personal and professional life separated. Drawing on some deep inner strength, she was holding herself together with brains, guts, hope, and her love for her 3 sons. But with every passing day, her situation was becoming more and more unbearable. Chapter 23. In the fall of 1985, Cheryl's sister Susan was living in Seattle, working toward a degree in sociology at the University of Washington. Her apartment there was always available to Cheryl when she had to be in Seattle on business for Garvey Schubert. She had her own key, and she averaged 1 visit a month. Occasionally, she could even prevail upon Brad to bring the boys up so they could all be together. She missed them so much. Sometimes Susan was there, sometimes the apartment was empty. Since Susan's fiancé, David Keegan, was in Longview, and she often went to see him, Cheryl was occasionally alone in Susan's apartment. But more often they were there together. They were both grown women now, and were friends as well as sisters. That fall of 1985 was the first time Brad explicitly accused Cheryl of having extramarital affairs, and once he had begun, he continually railed at her about her alleged infidelity. It is an all-too-common ploy for a man who is cheating to diffuse suspicion by accusing his wife of what he himself is doing, and it's quite possible that Cheryl did have 1 or 2 fleeting relationships with other men late in 1985 and early in 1986. Who could have blamed her? "The police asked me about it later," Susan recalled, "and I told them I didn't know if Cheryl was seeing other men or not, but I told them I hoped she was. She needed someone in her life who made her happy, someone who cared about her. She knew that Brad was cheating on her. She'd known it for a long time, but I think she tried to look away from that. She tried not to think about it." Cheryl was a beautiful woman, only 35, and she still drew attention from men. Her years with Brad had well nigh obliterated her self-esteem. When the men she worked with occasionally complimented her, she almost looked around to see whom they were talking about. The experience of having a man actually treat her well, tell her positive things, even hold her with tenderness, was something she had forgotten. Cheryl was a vulnerable woman and terribly sad. All her successes in courtrooms and in boardrooms faded when she realized how alone she was. She was married, but her husband didn't love her. Beyond her value as a wage earner, she had become a mere convenience, an irritant. If she had an affair or two, they were brief and born of desperate loneliness rather than passion. If she had an affair, Susan didn't know about it. She smiled as she remembered a time in the late summer of 1985. Cheryl was in Seattle and stayed with me. We went to the Red Robin, a popular upscale Seattle hamburger restaurant, and we both ordered margaritas. We were having fun. I was in college by then. Then we went to the Red Onion down by Madison Park. These two guys came over to our table, and they were coming on to us. Cheryl just winked at me. All of a sudden, one of the guys looked close at Cheryl, and he said, "You're wearing married lipstick." Cheryl laughed and said, "Well, I guess that's it. I'm not changing shades anytime soon." Cheryl hadn't taken the men seriously, and Susan knew it. Cheryl was responsible. Brad was the first dangerous thing she ever did. She was embarrassed that she was pregnant when she married him. She didn't tell anyone in the family that she was pregnant until she was 5 months. Brad saw accusations of infidelity as a way to harass and humiliate his wife. Smugly, armed with the names of two men he believed Cheryl had been intimate with, he embarked on a tell-all campaign that he felt sure would ruin Cheryl's career. He first called the wife of a senior partner at Garvey Schubert and told her that Cheryl had slept with her husband. It may have been true, it may not. Either way, the wife's reaction was not what Brad had expected. She was not hysterical, nor was she grateful to Brad for his report. With impeccable class, she called Cheryl and asked her to convey a message to her husband. "Just tell him that I don't care to talk to him for several days. He'll understand." Mortified and puzzled, Cheryl passed on the message. Annoyed that his sabotage hadn't worked, Brad went a step further. He contacted Stuart Hennessy, who had worked with Cheryl in Seattle, and invited him out for a drink in the bar at the Alexis Hotel near the Garvey Schubert offices. Hennessy would remember the encounter as a weird experience. Brad told him that he and Cheryl were separated and quickly went on to give Hennessy offensive details about Cheryl's supposed promiscuity. Hennessy stared back at him, disbelieving and disgusted. "Then he asked how the firm was doing," Hennessy recalled, "and he asked how much money I made." What Brad really wanted to know, of course, was how much money Cheryl was making and how much her retirement fund was worth. Hennessy stood up to leave and told Brad he didn't want to discuss it. That was private information. He left Brad sitting with two untouched drinks while he went back to his office, shaking his head in shock at Brad's gall and crudeness. Hennessy called Cheryl to alert her to what Brad was saying. "Cheryl was a strong person," he said, "but she was crying. She said, 'Stu, he's trying to ruin me.'" Hennessy didn't know how to help her beyond telling her that her friends were behind her and wouldn't believe Brad's lies. Neither reaction was what Brad had expected, and for the moment he was thrown off stride. He resented Cheryl's independence and success. He had hoped to humiliate her and ruin her career. She was humiliated, but her job was never in danger. She was also puzzled. If Brad had succeeded in getting her fired, who did he think was going to support them? It was her salary that kept them afloat. She had seen him do this before, act out of rage and spite himself in the process. Cheryl was horribly embarrassed by Brad's vicious lies, but she held her head up and her career never missed a beat. Even so, Susan could see that the enmity in Cheryl's relationship with Brad was intensifying, and as it did, she saw, too, that the essence that was Cheryl had begun, finally, to disintegrate. As water eventually erodes stone after an eon of continual dripping, Brad's relentless siege against Cheryl was working its devastation. She had been so strong for so long, but now she was growing thinner and thinner, toying with her food and only pretending to eat. Still, through sheer force of will, she was able to compartmentalize her life so that she could concentrate on her work and take care of her boys. Chapter 24. Brad's affair with Lilia Sarnan had continued, even as he pointed accusing fingers at Cheryl. In late fall, Lilia was told that she needed a kidney transplant. Brad was tremendously solicitous, so much so that he offered to pay her medical bills. He gave her $4,000. She had the transplant operation on November 28, 1985, and testifying in a legal hearing sometime later, Lilia had difficulty remembering if Brad had actually paid for her surgery. Staring into Brad's dark eyes from her position on the witness chair, she equivocated. She thought that their affair had lasted somewhere between 6 months and a year. She couldn't really remember. Lilia did remember that Brad had paid the rent on her apartment in the Madison Tower for some time. Although her ground floor unit wasn't as expensive as the 18th floor apartment he would soon rent, it wasn't cheap either. But if Brad proved to be a friend in need, his passion for Lilia faded after her surgery. The immunosuppressant medicine she had to take had side effects that repulsed Brad. "She grew facial hair, and that turned me off," he said later. And so Lilia had gone on to her relationship with Dr. Clay Watson, the surgeon at Providence, although she remained in her apartment at the Madison Tower until late fall of 1986. Earlier that year, she had introduced Brad to Dr. Sarah Gordon, and apparently there were no hard feelings. Lilia and Brad were like dancers who changed partners when the song changed. Lilia did seem a little chagrined, however, when she later learned that Brad was having an affair with Marnie, his teenage babysitter, at the same time he was sleeping with her. Lilia had first known Brad in Salem when he was hired by Citizens Savings, and then Brad, Lilia, a secretary, and a young lawyer named Karen Aborg were transferred to the Lake Oswego branch of the bank. Karen would later testify that federal bank examiners had questioned the Lake Oswego books. The branch's president and most of its directors had been summarily fired, and Brad was elevated to a position of extreme trust as he and his three female assistants evaluated the extent of the damage. They soon suspected that they would only be tidying up loose ends and closing the branch down. It was doubtful that the commercial loan division in Lake Oswego was going to survive, but as long as the branch was still open, Brad was the boss. He was also a sultan with his own little harem. Brad had scarcely ended his affair with Lilia when he became very close to Karen Aborg. Another man might have felt ill at ease working in the same small office as two of his girlfriends, but it didn't bother Brad. Lilia was aware that her ex-lover was engaged in daily disputes with his wife. Karen was not, at least for a time. When she first went to work for Brad, she knew almost nothing about his personal life. Brad had hired Karen to work for him in Salem in the summer of 1985. She was very young, barely out of law school, and she was Brad's type. Small, attractive, slender, smart. He liked blonde or light brown hair and pretty, small-featured faces. At the bank, her title was loan closer, and later Brad chose her to go with him and Lilia to close the Lake Oswego branch. To Karen's somewhat naive eye, Brad seemed happily married when she first went to work for him. "It seemed to change rather rapidly," she recalled. It wasn't long before Karen suspected that Brad and Lilia had had a physical relationship, but she wasn't positive. It was just something in the way they exchanged glances and the sentences they left unfinished.